I am Nick Gillespie with the Reason TV Talk Show. My co-host is Reason's Michael C. Moynihan. And our guests today are Michael Barone of U.S. News and World Report and the American Enterprise Institute, and the author most recently of Our First Revolution, a book about the Glorious Revolution in England. Our other guest is Raihan Salam of The Atlantic and of the New America Foundation, and the author or co-author of Grand New Party. Gents, thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Nick.
Let's talk, Raihan, about the GOP. It's in a meltdown, it seems. I caught up on some reading, and they lost the last election badly sometime last year. What's your prescription for turning the grand old party into a grand new party?
The prescription is for the party to have more of a policy focus, to move away from a narrow focus on tax cuts, and to address a lot of the anxieties that American families have today about their economic future, not just lower middle class and working class families, so that was the focus of our book, but also a lot of upper middle class families who share the same anxieties.
What did the Bush administration not address in terms of that? They did a lot of social policy. They talked a lot about social policy. They had a foreign policy that was wildly unpopular as well. So what are you talking about?
Well, they talked a lot about social policy, and actually the tone of their talk about social policy was about compassion. It was about looking out for the least fortunate rather than, you know, looking out for those who work hard and play by the rules. Mm-hmm. There's obviously a place for looking out for the least fortunate, but I think that, you know, failing
to
emphasize...
But not in the Republican Party?
No, you talk about it in the Republican Party, but the way that, you know, the tone of it was incredibly condescending, A. B, you actually didn't talk about this massive, massive problem that's happening.
What's the
which
problem?
The massive problem is that, you know, kind of lots of middle-class families just are finding themselves, you know, facing radically different economic circumstances that seem to make, you know, familiar ways of life unviable. Now, that's not a problem in the sense that, you
wait,
know...
Wait, but yeah. Just concretely, so what are you talking about, the loss of manufacturing jobs? Or what? I mean, what's a specific policy that comes out of that?
Lots of different things are at work, and to kind of, you know, really unravel it, you have to look at a lot of different things. You have to look at tax policy. You have to look at the composition of the workforce. You have to look at sort of demographics, the age structure of the population, and you're seeing all these things interrelate in a way that's leading people to see, hey, you know, my parents lived and worked a certain way. Mm-hmm. I can't do that same thing. Now, to me, there's a level of, well, get over it, you know, sort of get on with your life. But there's also a level of, look, if you look at the tax and regulatory environment, it was meant to accommodate a different set of circumstances that we need to reform.
What's a specific reform that needs to be made?
Okay, one specific reform is when you look at our tax code right now, you know, it's completely destructive of economic growth, and it's also something that, you know, kind of impacts people in these hilariously uneven ways. You know, you were talking before, you know, about the property tax. In California, you have the situation where you have, you know, two houses right next to each other. One person is paying eight times the property tax as someone else. If you look at the way that we, you know, kind of distribute the tax burden right now through tax subsidies that are, you know, essentially a form of spending, you know, you're radically privileging some people over other people in ways that are totally irrational, rather than a kind of simple, straightforward way that is, you know, basically transparent and that is actually encouraging people to work.
Michael, what are you thinking?
Well, Raihan's onto something here, and I think his book's got a lot of interesting things in it.
You referred to him and his co-author Ross Douthat as dazzlingly.
Yeah, I'd like to retract that.
You'd like to retract what your assistant wrote?
I've never had an assistant.
Book, but totally off
you actually finished the damn thing. Yeah. Anyway, I see it somewhat differently. I mean, we're speaking now at a time when we've suddenly had, you know, a significant diminution of wealth the part of ordinary people. You know, most people in our society over the last 25 years accumulate significant wealth over the course of their lifetime. They don't like to think about it perhaps that way, but they do. I mean, the median, when the Federal Reserve gives you those numbers, they say most people have no wealth. You need to disaggregate that by age. 55 to 64 is actually the median wealth was, last time I looked, somewhere, you know, in the vicinity of $500,000. There was some significant wealth there, and you get entitlements to Social Security and so forth. Obviously, that's ratcheted down by some significant figure over the last 12 months.
Although it's not like it's
months.
Disappeared.
It hasn't disappeared.
Yeah.
As I told my broker
surplus.
The other day, you know, the market going to go down 7,000 more points. That's
right.
The good news. there's limited losses here. So,
but now, I mean, one of the general prescriptions that Raihan makes is that the Republican Party, if it wants to have a future, and we'll talk later about why we should care if the Republican Party has a future, but is to go down market a bit. And you have talked about it being more going up market.
Well, tentatively, yeah. I mean, it seems to me that at least in the short run, there are more votes available to Republicans on the top end of the income and education scales and the low end of the age scale. I mean, particularly the age scale, I think, is a big deal for them. Obama carried under 30 voters by 66% to 32%. That's
does that have anything to do with the fact that the Republicans ran a 900-year-old man?
Well, I think some of the you know, contrast of the candidate's personal character and so forth is a part of that. Right. But the vote was a 63-34 for members of the House. You know, John McCain carried the young vote in nine states with 57 electoral votes. That doesn't suggest that a happy future for the Republican Party if that generation keeps voting that way. Now, some people say, well, when they start owning homes or doing this and that, they'll behave somewhat differently. I think they'll also respond quite possibly.
If they ever put in a Vietnamese POW camp. You know.
Well, and if you know, if some of these policies are suggested in the Obama budget, have the effect of deadening the economy and putting us in a prolonged slump, which I think it's certainly possible.
Yeah. And you're hoping for that, aren't you? I'm hoping that Obama fails.
I'm hoping that America succeeds.
I will be the only one on the panel that will admit that I'm hoping Obama fails on these particular policies. We were discussing this, the Rush Limbaugh speech, and that this thing at
CPAC.
AEI last night, that you were at. There was a lot of references to Limbaugh. What did both of you, and Raihan, this might be more specifically to you, because you were sort of referenced in that speech, weren't you?
In the Limbaugh speech.
In the Limbaugh speech.
I was, too.
Yeah. Okay.
And you were, too.
I was at the George Will dinner for Barack Obama January
13th. Oh, so you're one of those.
Reference
right,
to
inside the Beltway.
Now, he didn't name either of us.
No, he didn't name either. Okay. He didn't, by name, no, but it was by inference, obviously. So the thing is that we're talking about going up market, down market.
Yeah.
You know, Limbaugh and a lot of people, the people that I talked to at CPAC, there was a real sort of culture war slash class warfare, like you people inside the Beltway, and the word elites is being bandied about quite a bit. What do you guys make of this? And, you know, Limbaugh actually, driving this kind of rhetoric.
I'll let Michael answer that first. I have some strong views on that question, but
I can't stand, as a graduate of Harvard and Yale, I can't stand elites. So I inveigh against them all the time. I think some of this misses the point. I mean, the Republican Party, conservatives, libertarians, all of us need to be thinking about what kind of public policies can work in the future, what kind of can work for the country, can work, as I used to say when I was a political consultant, can works for you in the primary, works for you in the general, works for you governing. And at CPAC, a lot of the stuff I heard, including from Limbaugh, is we don't have to change or anything.
He specifically said we don't have to change any of our policies. Right?
We don't have to change any of our I mean, in some sense, that's ridiculous because the needs of public policy change as the times change. In 1980, you know, Reagan came in, there was 50% marginal tax rate, 70% on, quote, unearned income. The case for tax cuts was different from what it is today when we've got 35% and Obama's going to raise that to 39.6 plus actually a little more not giving you the mortgage interest and charitable deductions. Public policy's in a different place, you got to be thinking about the future. My suggestion to Republicans, conservatives, and I guess to libertarians is that emphasize people should have choices in their life. Choose your future. I mean, Obama had this 21st century campaign with lots of individual participation, My Obama. He's advocating mid-20th century welfare state proposals, command and control, centralized command, government knows what's best for you, we'll take more of your money and then everything will be fine for you. I think that there's a tension between those two things, a tension between what attracted so many young people to Obama, this generation that's used to clicking on there. They don't wait for the radio to tell them what the top 40 is. They have their own playlists on their iPods. And this mid-20th century, you know, British Labour Party 1945 type public policies
or
that
best
he's
and
going
the brightest, where there's a few people who can, you know, who know what's best.
Larry Summers can make decisions for the rest of us. Well, with all due respect to Larry Summers, who is almost as smart as he thinks he is, which is really smart. You know, I don't think that's the direction that's in line with the grain of society as it's developing.
Let's take a break, and then we're going to come back.
Real men of genius.
Real men of genius.
Today, Reason TV salutes you, Mr. Plagiarizing, gaff-prone, hair-plug-wearing Vice President. You turned against the Iraq War, but you've dropped more bombs than George W. Bush.
My memory is not as good as Justice Roberts, the Chief Justice Roberts.
Why'd I pick this dude?
You're the perfect opening act for a president who wants to look good by comparison.
I tell you, man, I always liked Barack, but I love her.
Never the lights of love.
And you're never afraid to call a spade a spade.
Who is articulate and bright
Joe! When you're not pretending to eat at places that closed 20 years ago, you're pretending that other people's words are your own. When you're not creating the drug czar's office, you're talking crazy as all shit.
You cannot go to a 7-Eleven or a Dunkin' Donuts unless you have a slight Indian accent.
It's good to know that the vice president isn't evil anymore, just dumber than Dan Quayle.
Chuck Graham, state senator's here. Chuck, stand up, Chuck. Let him see you. Oh, God love you. What am I talking about?
And we're back.
Yeah, Raihan, specific to the Limbaugh question, Limbaugh has attacked you quite a bit.
Yep.
What and attacked you, I think, specifically on his radio show by name, right?
Oh, he is very good at not using names, because I think that he's very good at not using names. It's actually very crafty, because by using a name, you're actually deigning to use a name. You're actually elevating someone.
True.
I think of Rush Limbaugh. I actually have a shrine in my home made of pewter to Rush Limbaugh. And actually, you know, what I do is I feed it quarters, and actually it expands slowly sort of over time.
You've been doing a great job.
Is it going to turn into silver?
Slowly. So I actually believe that the United States needs to change its name to the United States of Limbaugh.
Yeah,
okay. And I think that we all need to actually swear fealty to him.
I think it's utterly
specious.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you've got Jefferson, Lincoln, Limbaugh. It's as simple as that. I mean, he really deserves the praise that Eric Erickson of Red State and others have given him, because this is not just a man. When he takes Oxycontin, it's actually he's doing it for the rest of us, much like Christ.
I know.
It's a kind of transubstantiation. It's a mystical process.
But now, what's wrong with his declaration that?
If by what's wrong you mean what's right, then I think that actually his species of nihilism, as a, you know, kind of my, you know, old boss David Brooks called it, if you call that nihilism, that sort of, you know, that's good. Look, Rush Limbaugh is Jon Stewart. Is Oprah. You know what I mean? He's fantastically entertaining. He's incredibly good at lambasting and ridiculing people. That's a skill. I mean, you know, Henny Youngman,
it's a little unfair to call him a nihilist or something. I would say many ways he's, you know, he's philosophically kind of libertarian.
Oh, no, no. I think that's absolutely right.
I don't think so.
I think there's a lot to that.
He's a big blowhard.
Lower taxes and stuff like that.
You know, to go back to your point, I think you're absolutely right, and it's a note that we've been hitting for years now in Reason, which is that the real way of talking about American politics is not right and left. It's choice versus control. And that this is Matt Welch, the
Well, Russia's mostly on the side of choice,
I think. Well, you know, he says he is, but he's not in terms of lifestyle choice. He's not in terms of, he'll talk about school choice, but, I mean, he doesn't even advocate any. I mean, I think it's a mistake to even talk about him because he's not a political player. But
he's an opinion shaper in an interesting way. I mean, I tune into his show when I'm in the car between 12 and 3 Eastern he's part of the conversation.
Do you go out to your car and sit in it during 12 to 3?
Not when it's
they
so
called
cold.
It a driveway moment. I think that Michael
is
right.
In the garage. I think that, with the gas.
Yeah. I think Michael is right in the sense that, you know, Limbaugh represents a 1985 libertarianism. He doesn't represent libertarianism kind of as understood.
Back then. But, when he used to do caller abortions, he was much more iconoclastic, and he took on... Yeah. He took on authority figures. I thought he was more interesting than them. But let's drop him and go to this question of choice. If the Democrats are not going to be the party of choice, and it's absolutely, I think, accurate that Barack Obama excited people because he seemed to offer them an embodiment of an increasingly individualized America where you get to pick your, you know, you get to pick your music, you get to pick your coffee drinks, et cetera. He's not going to deliver that. How can the Republicans, who are famous for, other than taxes, you know, you should get to keep as much of your money as you want as long as you don't spend it in ways that I disapprove of?
Well, you know, I think they have to think through the policy things. And one of the things that Ryan addresses and Ross addressed in Grand New Party and other things is that as efficacious as it may be to economic growth to lower the tax rates on high earners, the ordinary person is not really hugely burdened by the income tax these days. We've got 40% of households not paying federal income tax. You've got, you know, the payroll tax is hits them fairly heavily, and in fact, you know, some conservatives were advocating cutting the payroll tax holiday as a means of economic stimulus. I think there's a lot to say for that as a public policy.
Which would be a fascinating experiment.
It would be a fascinating experiment. It would tend to undermine, you know, the old, you know, connection between your, quote, contributions to Social Security and try staying out of jail if you don't contribute versus and the benefit structure and so forth. But, you know, you've had another problem in that compensation for ordinary people has increased, but, you know, the healthcare paychecks have not. Mm-hmm. Most of it's been taken up by health care provision. Right. Now, you can make an argument that we actually get something quite worthwhile out of that because lifespans are increased, quality of life is increased by advanced medical treatment. You've got Tom Daschle and other Democrats saying basically that, we're going to give you a centralized system, and the way we're going to save money is denial of care. You know, like in Britain, the guy comes in for a hip replacement, which is a fairly standard operation. They say, well, no, you're too old. You're 57. Mm. Well, you know, actuarially, he's got 30 years to go, but they don't think that's very important. Saves money. It's like the old Soviet cardiac clinic. It was a fifth-floor walk-up. Saved a lot of money.
What is the policy, then, that you do to bring choice to health care? Because this is, as much as anything, it's that people, you know, people don't have choice.
Well, health savings accounts, the Bush administration and the Republican Congress tried to push the system some distance in that direction through the Medicare prescription drug bill. And I'm not qualified. I think other arguments can be made in favor. We have seen a burgeoning of health savings accounts. Yeah. The Democrats now want to cut that back. You know, this is an evolving system, and it changes every year as people make different choices on their health insurance.
I have to say, I mean, I think that if you want more choice, you actually have to have hybrid systems. If you look at Singapore, for example, I mean, they use forced savings, but what they do have is an incredibly transparent market for health care services. Right. Creating HSAs on top of a completely broken, jury-rigged system is not actually, I mean, you know, and I'm sympathetic to these guys. I'm sympathetic to actually creating real markets and real transparency in this space, but I think that one problem with a lot of libertarians, not the libertarians associated with reason, thankfully, but is, you know, kind of how narrowly we look at a lot of this stuff. Mm-hmm. Because I think that, you know, when you're looking at taxes, the tax burden, look at tax subsidies. I mean, you look at the whole picture and look at the fact that tax cuts now, if they lead to tax increases later, they're not doing you any good. This was the Milton Friedman insight. This is what Reagan believed before 78, which is that it's spending that's the actual tax. And, you know, spending, if it comes in the form of tax expenditures, it's still spending. And similarly, you know, if you're looking at, you know, Will Wilkinson, a friend of reason and a friend of mine, is, you know, pointing to Denmark.
He's no friend of Michael's, though. I'll tell you.
No friend of Michael's.
Who's that?
Brilliant, young, kind of libertarian thinker. thinker, but sort of who's actually trying to reconcile how, you know, a lot of liberal goals, a lot of libertarian goals are broadly shared. But, you know, the issue is when you look at Denmark, they have an incredibly free economy. In terms of the choices that people have, you have a lot of them. Now, granted, you know, kind of you have such high tax rates that you're driving out a lot of the talent. I mean, you know, kind of fortunately they're EU citizens. Yeah, they can sort of...
Well, the other problem is that we are not a nation of 305 million Danes.
Yeah, Michael, I absolutely agree with you. Yeah, but I mean, the issue is you have to look at these questions, these public policy questions, a little bit more broadly, because the discourse that we have in the U.S., it's a legacy of, you know, the permanent tax revolt. We actually started talking about a couple of things, you know, kind of in a way that actually didn't end up making a huge amount of sense. You had political entrepreneurs who saw that, yeah, we've got to decouple sort of tax, we've got to talk about tax temptation and opportunity there.
One of the things with health care is that, as you know, even something like a high deductible insurance program.
Reason advocated universal high deductible health insurance is a brilliant idea.
No, but what I'm saying is that even in this system, suddenly, and I'm currently under one where, you know, my doctor for the first time was like, okay, you know, how much does this drug cost, et cetera.
Right.
And
that
it
makes
starts
a huge
to
difference.
Inject price signals into a system, which might lead.
But do you really want to take Lipitor? Would you rather get a generic?
Yeah. Or
absolutely.
Would you just, you know, finally get off the whole cholesterol
and
conspiracy
so
anyway?
So you get off Lipitor and short your Pfizer stock.
No, but I mean, what I'm saying is that whatever you can do to inject more choices into any given system, I mean, prices are choices. I mean, because they're always equilibrating different valuations of the same product
at
any given point.
One cultural problem we have, though, is that, you know, you have this problem where actually lots of people want to surrender choices, and this is the whole, you know, paradox of choice notion, et cetera. And I think that, you know, Keith Joseph talked about the pocket money society, you know, in the 70s. And, you know,
the pocket money, the pocket Visa.
Just the idea that, you know, there's a danger of a society when all the big ticket expenditures, all the big ticket decisions are made by people who are not you. And there are lots of people who, you know, lots of stressed upper middle class families who are frankly like, I want to offload this stuff.
So that's an ongoing thing.
Yeah. And that's a deep cultural problem that's not going to be solved by politics.
And it has been since the colonial.
What I'm saying is that part of the issue is we have to make arguments outside of the context of politics and outside of the context of elections.
But Ryan,
that's actually a deep thing.
How does one make these arguments to the average voter? We did a lot of video stuff for a reason where we went out to Obama-type rallies and asked people what their concerns were, why they were voting for Obama. These people weren't sort of frothing at the mouth liberals, you know, that were, you know, sort of just reading Foucault and decided that this is the closest to my ideology. These are people that had sort of real concerns. So how do you explain to somebody, and this is the question that's very difficult, because Obama has a, you know, an elevator pitch, a simple sentence. How do you explain to somebody that we need more choice in health care to lower health care costs, et cetera, et cetera?
Well, you use language that sounds a lot like what you just said. I mean, I think there is some dialogue, you know, the political dialogue on that. I used to be a political consultant, and how do you get policy arguments down into campaign slogans? How do you emphasize three issues? What do you knit it together?
It's much more difficult to say when, you know, everyone should have health care, full stop, as the Obama campaign is, to say that, yes, but it's not that easy. I mean, making that argument.
I think that the positive way for people that want more in the way of markets and less in the way of centralized government command and control is to talk about choices and to use, you know, the abortion rights people use that euphemism choice. It has come
just
to
like
mean
those
half an abortion.
At school choice.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
You know,
I think
sinister.
I think for a certain generation, particularly of women of you know, baby boom age, the word choice was a proxy for the choices they had made in their personal lives, which were in conflict with what they had been told when they were growing up they should do. I think that's now a little antique. The generation of young women have not been grown up saying that they're evil if they go out and get a job in the workforce.
But the rhetorical impact of choice was perfect for women because there was a proliferation of choices.
Yeah.
Biological choice was one of those.
It was the euphemism a proxy for a whole bunch of choices that were very important to people's lives.
We only have a couple of minutes left, but Michael, your book, Our First Revolution, The Remarkable British Upheaval That Inspired America's Founding Fathers, is about the Glorious Revolution. Give us the campaign slogan of why this book is relevant in today's America.
Well, this was a very unlikely set of events. The ouster of an English king, the Catholic James II, the installation of a Dutch prince, William of Orange, as King of England, and his wife Mary, who was James's daughter by his first marriage. It was a giant step forward for representative government, guaranteed liberties, global capitalism, and the kind of choices we're talking about now.
So you're saying we have to oust Barack Obama?
And well, find a random Dutch person on the
Catholic.
Street.
It's, James,
you know, it's
was
a system. It's a system.
He was a secret Catholic, no, just like Obama was a secret Catholic.
No, he wasn't a secret Catholic. He proclaimed it. I mean, he became a secret Catholic in 1673, but by 1681 it was well known and so forth. You know, what's interesting is that you do get the emergence of something like two-party politics. You get in representative government.
Limited
but we get things, large parts of things like the First Amendment, the Second Amendment are really part of this glorious revolution, so named by its proponents, in 1688-89. And it was happy chance to a considerable extent. I mean, William of Orange assembled an army of 25,000 men in secret and took it across the English Channel in boats and a ship fleet of 500 ships in November, not a month you advise people to sail the English Channel. And he distributed through England in secret, had printed up in the Netherlands, a pamphlets. This is the blogs of the day. 50,000 circulating in a country of 5 million and secretly circulated them against the king. So this was an enterprise of quite daring. William of Orange was quite an outstanding man.
How was he with the Irish?
Well, with the Irish, he wanted to have sort of religious toleration, but Irish Protestants kind of took it over, and, you know, there have been continuing fights in the 16th, 17th century about who owned the land in Ireland, this and that, and so, it didn't turn out so well for the Irish. It took a few centuries to get things in shape.
The Glorious Revolution and before that, the English Civil War as well, which this is really, the Glorious Revolution is kind of the last act of that.
And it becomes, they want to avoid.
Very influential in the American founding.
Our world would not be the same. If these events had not happened in 1688-89, and it would be the poorer for it on balance.
Yeah. All right. Well, we'll leave it there. Thank you for the Reason TV talk show. I'm Nick Gillespie. My co-host is Michael C. Moynihan. And our guests today were Michael Barone and Raihan Salam.